Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to At The Controls with Jonathan Ledyard and Mark Gallagher, the podcast which takes inspiration from Formula One, the people, the passion, the technology and the positive philosophy which underpins the sport. And if there's one team on the grid, possibly on the planet, which knows how to develop the perfect blend of all those qualities, it's the newly crowned seven times Constructors Champions, Mercedes. And in this special episode, we're joined by none other than the team's technical director, James Allison. And we've paired him, Mark, with one of Formula One's most high-ranking fans, a man who's pulled more G in his flying career than Lewis Hamilton could ever dream of, surely.
Absolutely. Chris Papiano is currently commanding officer, can you believe, of strike at the Naval Aviation Warfighting Development Center. That's quite a mouthful, but a very impressive facility based in Fallon in Nevada. Chris is a former Top Gun commander. Yes, you heard that right. Who has worked closely with a certain Mr. Tom Cruise in the much anticipated, but unfortunately COVID delayed Top Gun sequel. Now, the thing about Chris, he's passionate about Formula One. I've had the good fortune to get to know him recently. And he follows every race from his home in Nevada. And we'll be talking to Chris about the parallels between being at the controls in Formula One and naval aviation. Now, in case you didn't know, James Allison's father is Air Chief Marshal Sir John Allison, a former Commander-in-Chief himself of Strike Command, RAF Strike Command, that is. Later, he was Director of Strategy at Jaguar Racing Formula One team, while son James is a competitive aerobatics pilot. So you can understand why we and they were so keen to link up and compare notes and talk about their mutual passions.
And they talk incredibly well. And we're also going to be meeting the former Toyota Motorsport engineer who wowed the Mercedes team with a speech to the factory last year. And he's just written a remarkable book detailing the fighter plane engine war in Europe during World War II. He'll be explaining why all of us are still benefiting from the technical genius of those wartime designers and why motorsport has become such a force for technological change. But just before we hear from James and Chris, just some reflections, Mark, on what Mercedes have achieved, what they did at Imola. Seven titles in a row they've now got. They've won 100 of the last 134 races. They've had 58 1-2 finishes in this hybrid era. Surely they have raised the business of winning to a new level.
Yeah, they sure have. And, you know, the statistics keep on coming from that team and certainly from Lewis Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas. My takeaway from it all, when you look at the multitude of statistics that the media have been reporting about Mercedes' success, my takeaway from it all is, frankly, what a formidable team of people they have. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. But they have shown the rest of the field what it's like to have the perfect structure, the perfect organization. They've got the right funding. They've clearly got great facilities. They do everything in-house, something that Red Bull could maybe do with learning from. They are absolutely laser-focused on being the very best Formula One team. And that's what they're getting out of it. They have none of the compromises that seem to be part of the landscape with all the other nine Formula One teams. Don't care who you talk about, every other team has a compromise of some kind built into it. Mercedes is an uncompromising competitor, and my word, they have turned the world of Formula One on its head. Totally dominant team. Some people find it quite boring to watch. Actually, we're seeing the very best in their business repeating and sustaining that success season after season, race after race. It's incredibly impressive. The rest simply have to find a way to match that.
What about the post-race remarks from both Toto Wolff and Lewis Hamilton, casting doubt on their future, saying, Toto Wolff saying that everyone has a shelf life and I've reached the end of my shelf life. Lewis Hamilton saying, I don't know whether I'm going to be in the sport in Formula One in 2021. Is this, do you think, the end of an era? Or is this just a ramping up of negotiations for 2021 with both considering their plans and roles for the future?
You know, Jonathan, this has been a funny year for everyone, hasn't it? 2020 with COVID and lockdown, the pandemic and all the implications of that. And I think most of us have at some point kind of reflected on our life and where it's going and what's going to happen post-COVID. And it seems that Toto Wolff has certainly been having this, you know, same thoughts. He's enjoyed spending more time than ever in his life with his family, particularly with, he and Susie and their young child. And it's pausing him to think, do I really want to chase my tail all around the world going to 22 Grand Prix. Then, of course, you have Lewis Hamilton, 35 years of age. As we've just said, you know, winning, he's about to win his seventh world championship. And, you know, what's he been thinking about his future? How long does he want to keep going? So I don't think it's a surprise to hear the two of them, because they are very authentic in how they explain to the media their thought processes about where they are within our sport. And at the moment, the two of them clearly have key decisions to make. It feels very much that there may also be a slightly underlying negotiating point going on here, where Lewis is effectively saying to Toto Wolff, you know, it's not 100% sure that I could be around. You need to make sure that I have the right package. And maybe even Toto's playing a little bit of that game himself and saying, you know, Lewis, not everyone is, you know, no one is indispensable, me included. You have to say, however, that any comments that were made of that kind have been balanced by both of them making it very clear they're going to be around for some time. So I think when all the dust settles, yes, Toto may have a different job title. I think Toto Wolff will be leading the Mercedes-Benz Formula One organization in all its forms, inside and outside Formula One, for some time to come. And I think Lewis Hamilton will be continuing to win Grand Prix for the coming seasons.
Probably at the next race in Turkey, where Lewis can win his seventh world championship, which is a magnificent achievement. And this is just a period of unprecedented success in Formula One for Hamilton and Mercedes. No other Formula One team has achieved such prolonged consistency. James Allison joining seemingly as technical director in 2017. But as you'll hear, James is modest to a fault, humble as well, very much like Chris Papiano, as we're about to find out, despite their respective high-profile positions. And Mark and I began our conversation with the two of them by asking James about those Mercedes title celebrations at the factory. How did he and the team mark such a feat? Or was it just business as usual, onwards towards championship number 8?
Well, it's not been a championship win like any other, because this dreaded virus has meant that we couldn't jump around and embrace each other in the way that we would do normally. And that's been a shame, because such a fantastic achievement for a group of people who merit it with the effort and skill they've brought to bear in such fine style. But we had a lovely day on Monday with the factory full of balloons and toasting each other from a distance with champagne and generally being pleased about the world. But you'd be surprised at what the half-life of these celebrations are, because we are fully back on it now, wading through the considerable difficulty of preparing for a very fat rule change next year with the introduction of the cost cap.
But you have been working on this car, the new car, as you might say, already, haven't you? I mean, that was one of the things which probably stuck in the craw of various of your rivals, thinking they're already focusing on the next year's car, and yet here they are setting the standard still very much in 2020.
Yeah, we've been going on next year's car for a good while. It's one of the luxuries that is afforded to you by having a strong championship. You can decide when you're going to switch your guns over to the following year, because you've acquired a sort of margin in points that allows you to do that. So yes, for several months now, we've been going on next year's car. But unusually for next year, it's not just about the technology, it's also about the process change and the restructuring that's necessary to deal with this other big regulation, which is the cost cap, and that's taking a fair amount of effort and time and thought. So we're glad of the ability to do that.
Before we get into that, just a thought about Lewis Hamilton and what he's brought to the team. I mean, you've worked with, you know, Michael Schumacher at Ferrari. You know, you've worked with Lewis as well, and championships just keep on rolling in. What's he brought to the team? What have you found that he's maybe surprised you, or just what he's delivered for the team?
Well, he's been metronomic. If you try and think of Lewis Hamilton errors in any given season, you're going to struggle to find more than one a year. And he's been at this extraordinary level of perfection for year after year after year. Puts me very much in mind of Michael in his pomp. But Lewis is properly integrated into this team in the same way Michael was back in the Ferrari days. And he gives us a weapon that we know if we do a car that is reliable and decently quick, we absolutely know he will get the job done for us. We also know if our car isn't quick enough, it's not because he's having an off day, because he doesn't have off days. It's because we've screwed up. And this is an incredibly useful sort of benchmark to measure ourselves against and to keep pushing us to higher and higher standards.
Chris, just turning to you, when you listen to James talking about Mercedes' success and the contribution that everyone in the organization has made to it, and Lewis's undoubted massive contribution that he's made, what's your view as a leader in a very different field, but observing it closely and with a high degree of fascination?
I see a lot of similarities between especially Top Gun and Mercedes Formula One team. I mean, Top Gun's been around for 50 years now. We've been focusing on winning in combat for 50 years now. It takes a very unique culture to do that. And, you know, of all the things I've read about Mercedes as a team, I see a lot of similarities with the culture they have and the leadership they have and what we do at Top Gun. Even down to, you know, the comparison between the pilots we have on the staff and Lewis, you know, credit to Lewis, that is hard to do, to be on top and stay and be as disciplined as he has been for as long as he has been, to continue almost, you know, flawlessly performing on the racetrack. And we hold our pilots to the same standard. And it takes a lot of discipline, a lot of passion and talent to be able to do that.
Now, there's a really interesting point you've just raised there, Chris. And James, I want to bring this back to you. So let's talk about team culture, because in Chris's case, it's a bit difficult for him to change teams because and if necessarily he's flying for the U.S. military. You've changed teams during the course of your career. You've spent time with Renault and Lotus. You spent time at Ferrari, and then you've had this pivotal role at Mercedes. Talk to us about the changes in culture, James, that you've witnessed between in the teams that you've driven for, and how important it is the culture of the people that really contributes to the success in what is such a technological sport.
I mean, I think we need to, first of all, let's not get carried away with the idea that it's night and day. The sport is incredibly competitive, so you're going to find way more that's similar between the teams than different. But those in something that is very competitive, then those differences create an edge for you that becomes the reason why a team is capable of prospering over another, despite the fact that we, you know, the us top three teams, we have broadly similar resources and skills. But what we have enjoyed in Mercedes for a good number of years is a culture where everybody stands up for their teammates in a way that feels very, very supportive and open. Telling fibs is like almost the worst thing you could do in this environment, in this culture. Pointing a finger at people and saying they're to blame for something is verboten in our world. And we try just to embrace failure as an opportunity to get better. It sounds cliched, but it really is super important that we do that. And we try also to ask teammates who are quite low down in the hierarchy to take quite large amounts of responsibility, because we think that the more brains and the more people we can get on side in our championship, the more powerful we are as a group. And that's a thing that is really done very, very well in this team.
It's been interesting during the preparation for the podcast. Chris, you were talking to us about the fact that you focus on the performance, not the performer. And I think that's something that is quite similar at Mercedes-Benz. Chris, talk to us about that, the importance of taking the view on the performance and then working to raise the whole team to the right level of capability.
As you said, you know, I can't change teams, but it's really similar to James's experience. You know, different teams, I would equate to different squadrons in naval aviation. And I've been in some fantastic squadrons to include Top Gun, and I've been in some squadrons where the culture was very preventative. That doesn't mean that those squadrons that were less than stellar couldn't go downrange and perform, just like a racing team that may not have the Mercedes culture can't go out on the racetrack and perform. But just as exactly as James said, you're looking for those that extra edge, and that's what you get out of a positive culture. And it's very similar. You need to have that open, safe communication culture where people are not afraid to bring up their mistakes and are worried about their jobs or their livelihood. You need to create that culture where people can bring up their stakes because you want them to. And so, you know, to equate it to, and I'm sure Mercedes does the same thing, when we come back from an event, we go into a debrief. You know, we focus on the performance. We don't call out anybody individually. If we're referring to somebody in that event, we refer to their flight call sign, vice their actual name. And we go through and we pull out all the mistakes. And just like James said, we're focused more so on the mistakes. That doesn't mean it's a brutal debrief by anything or by any stretch of the imagination. It just means we want to get better and get those incremental gains. So we put everything out on the table as far as individually and collectively what we did wrong and what we can do better as we go through. And if you ever see those environments where the debrief is too safe or not too safe, but rather guarded, that's when you know that you don't have the right culture, the right mindset going into it. So you're really looking for people to freely bring up their mistakes and the mistakes of others as you go through it.
How do you change the culture, though?
I took over command of an operational deploying fleet squadron several years ago, right before Top Gun. They were a very green crew. The culture wasn't ideally set for kind of your higher level performance. One, you kind of have to create a vision and explain to everybody what the culture needs to be like, and then you need to live it. And so I was bringing out my mistakes in the debrief to create that, to kind of show that to everybody else that, hey, I'm the CEO. I have the most experience in a fighter jet of anybody in this room. And you're hearing me call out even minor mistakes. Kind of that example sort of creates that safe environment. So you have to kind of go in and clearly delineate and communicate what the culture needs to be like. And then you need to live it every single day.
Does that sound like a chord with you, James? Exactly what you found when you joined Mercedes in 2017?
Absolutely. It's the living it part. You put a lot of effort self-consciously into trying to say what your values are, to describe the behaviors that you think support those values. You put that sort of intellectual effort in, but culture is a sticky thing, and it only really sticks if you're prepared to, having made that intellectual effort, to actually go out and do it. And you have to do it 100 times right for every half a time you might slip, because people will remember the slip far more strongly than the 100 times where you lived your values. But if you do have a sort of critical mass of people on the leadership side of the team that are telling and retelling that story and acting in a way that backs up the claim, then boy, oh boy, is it a weapon by the time the whole organization buys into that. And we've had in toto a fantastic team principal who has set the standard there, and the rest of us have bought into it. And the net result is an extraordinarily good environment to work in.
You mentioned Toto there. I mean, he then mentioned over the weekend at Imola that, you know, everyone has a shelf life and my shelf life is done. I'm moving on. How easy is that just to, if you take one person out, to pick up what Mark was saying, you've got your systems, you've got your processes. If he was to go, is it a seamless process just to carry on? Someone else moves in, someone else steps up or whatever, and still the Mercedes machine continues?
Well, I think for a large number of the components in the team, we would be able to cope with a loss. And in fact, we've got many examples of showing how we have gradually changed ourselves over time, changing technical directors, changing engineering directors, changing lots and lots of quite senior figures. But with decent succession plans, we're able to manage that. I would plead a special case in Toto's area. He is an unusual man and a massive asset to us. So I don't think he's in any danger of leaving us in the short term. And certainly we would be doing our best to keep a hold of him because he's top banana.
Chris, question for you. Just going back a little bit to what you're talking about, carrier operations. Talk to us as the uninitiated about carrier operations. You know, you as a pilot, you know, the detail of that, the complexity of the task that faces you when you're trying to land a jet aircraft on a carrier in the middle of the ocean somewhere, presumably under quite stressful, potentially stressful circumstances, and everything that goes in around that.
All right, I'll do my best. You know, the catch shots are pretty straightforward from a pilot's perspective. You're pretty much along for the ride. But, you know, the team that's around the airplane that is making that happen is massive. Everything from the guy that's driving the ship and making sure it's pointed into the wind and stays in the wind, which is a dynamic environment in the ocean. So there's a lot of corrections that need to be made there, to the catapult operators that are double, triple checking that the settings are right, to the final checkers that are surrounding the airplane to make sure that there's no leaks, the flight controls are working, the engines look good, and then you know, to the final checkers across the board for the catapult to make sure we've met all the requirements. And you know, from a pilot standpoint, I'm sitting there, I'm locked into the shuttle. I'm in full military power, which is full power without the afterburner. I'll cycle my controls when they let me do that and give me the signal. And if my engines look good, the controls look good, I salute. And now I just wait for the other team there that I'm solely relying upon at that point for my survivability to make sure their systems are good and everything's good from their end. And then we go. Landing is where carrier aviators make their money for sure. You know, even if you take a perfectly clear, calm day out on the water, as you roll in behind the boat, we'll start the landing about 3/4 mile behind the boat. You're trying to maintain a very, very specific glide slope that will get you safely over the ramp without hitting it. While you're doing that and managing that glide slope, you're also having to make sure you're staying on center line. You have about 4 feet on either side of slop from the center line before you start potentially hitting other airplanes on the rollout. It is extraordinarily challenging, like I said, even in a fair weather environment. You know, turn it into nighttime, turn it into, I've landed in snowstorms, I've landed in fog where you can't even see the boat until you're crossing the ramp, and then you'll start to see peripherally some of the metal on the boat. It gets very, very dynamic.
You've done that lately nearly 900 times, isn't that correct?
Yep.
To what extent is that landing automatable?
So we can go fully automated. We call it a mode one approach, where the airplane ties into the aircraft carrier, and the airplane really controls the movement of the airplane to make its adjustments as it goes through the trim. That's it. So it's very minute movements, but you can go fully automated. It's just, for me personally, it was always more comfortable if I'm going to get hurt or kill myself, then, you know, it needs to be my fault, not somebody else's.
James, do you fancy giving it a go?
I'm just gutted he doesn't trust the engineers. It's a disgrace. I love airplanes. I love flying, but I'm pretty aware of my limitations as a pilot, and I think that would be tall order.
So, talk to us about the flying that you do, James. Talk to us about, because obviously in the introduction to the podcast, we've explained your family background. I was very fortunate to work with your father at Jaguar Racing for a brief period of time.
Well, my dad was an Air Force pilot and a very, very keen private pilot. And so I was brought up surrounded by light aircraft and weekends mucking around with them. And I wanted to learn to fly, in part to be with my dad and have that shared experience. But as I got into flying myself, it's something that has stayed with me as a hobby and a passion for all of my adult life. So just a humble private pilot, but flown some reasonably interesting airplanes, and because I couldn't fly anything really fast and exciting, I tried to, as I could afford it, buy at least the high performance end of piston tail draggers, and just a fair amount of competition aerobatics, a bit of air show work, and just a huge amount of fun with it. And in terms of what I still do today, my job doesn't give me enough time to stay current enough to do the air shows or the competition aerobatics. So I just potter around in touring aeroplanes now, keeping vaguely current and enjoying being in the air.
What about the similarities, say, between an F1 driver and a fighter pilot? I mean, do you think that's been overplayed just because they're sitting in a cockpit and they're going very fast?
Well, I'd be interested in Chris's take on this, but I had a bit of a unique view on it, in as much as my father was a fighter pilot, pretty decent one at that. And he's pretty useful at controlling machinery and was always very interested in F1 and the like. And I think because as a fighter pilot, he'd been through a fairly intense selection process where most of the people who want to do it are weeded out because they don't have the skill and the aptitude to do it. And then once you get within the hallowed ranks of people that carry wings, there's then a further grading process, and the people flying fast jets are a sort of bit more of a upper echelon than the people that are put on transport aeroplanes. I have little doubt that had my father attempted to be a racing car driver, he would be better than the average bear. One of the things that people don't properly appreciate about Formula One drivers is how many people can drive, how many people think they're good drivers, how many people could make a living as a professional driver, and then how sharply the pyramid tapers off. And when you're ending up at the top end with the Lewis Hamiltons of the world, they are physical freaks in the same way as the people that can win tennis grand slams, or the very best footballers in the world, or any of these top level athletes where you look at them and you can't actually believe what you're seeing. And yet there is something about driving that makes your average bloke think, well, I could do that. Just maybe not quite as good, but I get close. And the reality is that the people at the top end of Formula One are special, special people. Maybe the breadth of their abilities is not what fighter pilots might be, because your average fighter pilot has to do far more than just control a machine. He has to fight it, has to work with other people in the sky and go off and subdue enemies in a very complicated tactical theater. Whereas a Formula One driver has this exquisite skill set that is so finely honed. And I think it's hard to appreciate just how exaggeratedly honed it is in these really top, top guys.
Fascinating. Chris, you're nodding. What do you think?
I completely agree. You know, there is certainly a tremendous filtering process, as James kind of explained to both, and as James's father went through. And, you know, at some point you're kind of getting up to the top of that ever increasing number of people at the top of the pyramid. I think, to James's point, you know, I think every fighter pilot would believe they could jump into a Formula One car and make something happen. You know, the skill sets and managing and controlling a vehicle of some type are certainly there. The feel of the vehicle is certainly there. You know, that there are unique differences at the very top of the pyramid. And I go to, if you remember from this last weekend, I think it was Gasly's move on Lewis Hamilton there going into turn one, and just his reaction time of coming off as Lewis went into that turn and coming back and falling back behind Lewis. That was a extraordinary reaction time. That was, to me, an example of kind of where the Formula One drivers are just finely tuned and honed into what they're doing. You couldn't take an average fighter pilot and throw them into a Formula One car and expect them to perform at that level. It's just different. I think they'll do certainly better than maybe your average Joe, but, you know, it's very different. Now, to James's point previously, with his flying experience, and James, I know you said, you know, landing on a carrier would be something outside your skill set. I would say being able to fly a tail dragger is something well outside of my skill set. And certainly I could easily teach you how to land on an aircraft carrier if you can do that.
Have we got a deal?
Certainly be a lot of fun.
Just to extend this a bit, in terms of, say, anyone who's watched the Top Gun movie. I mean, are we allowed to talk about Top Gun, the movie, Chris? I mean, is that just complete verboten? Don't talk about that. It has nothing to do with the real job, okay?
No, you can absolutely talk about it. Even though they won't admit it, typically, I will tell you that every fighter pilot today has watched that movie about 1,000 times and will admit to their close friends that that's part of the reason they joined this business.
Because there was a massive surge in recruitment, wasn't there? Something like 500% jump.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Is there still a fine within the U.S. Naval Force? If you mention Top Gun, right, that's it, $5, $10, whatever. You can't talk about it. I read about that somewhere just in the research.
Yeah, we had a prior Top Gun instructor throw that out there. We do just kind of jokingly as a staff on the Top Gun staff, we have a fine program. Only if you quote the movie, that's it. It's just if you quote it, then it's $5.
Okay, all right. But we'll come back to it maybe in a minute, because we still got to talk about Tom Cruise and how you work with him and tell him everything he knows about flying maybe. But in terms of how you manage people who are the special breed, both you and James have talked about this, about what makes a Formula One driver, the qualities which make a fighter pilot. How do you manage those personalities where there is rivalry, there is that competitive spirit, because you want to get up the ladder? And Toto Wolff has talked about it, and James will know all about it, you know, how you manage Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg, how difficult that was, why actually Valtteri Bottas and Lewis Hamilton are an easier pairing, as you might say, still a success. Mm-hmm. How do you manage those personalities to make sure you get the best out of them and they're not actually as like a running conflict?
Gosh, that's a great question, John. You know, one, on the Top Gun staff, we're very much about collaborative competition. We want to go out there and I want to develop you as a fighter pilot, or if I'm being instructed, the instructor is going to develop me as a fighter pilot, and we're going to fight each other as hard as we can. We will try to kick each other's butts as best we can out in the air, But as soon as we get back down on the ground, it's all about what we both could have done better, as we talked about previously with the debrief process. In the fleet squadron, it's a little bit different because you're dealing with a wide varying level or wide level of experience. Some are brand new to the airplane, basically, and others, you know, like the CEO, or have been flying and have several thousand hours in the airplane. What I've found kind of in my experience is you have different personalities and you have to approach those personalities differently. As an example, I may have somebody that's a junior officer that comes into the squadron and feels that he's made it. You know, this kind of goes back to James' point about rising up the hierarchy. They are now a junior officer in a fighter squadron. They're flying fighters. That was their goal and they've made it. And their desire to improve over time is just not there. Conversely, you may have somebody that comes in and comes into a really good fighter squadron. This is what we had on my first CO tour in my fleet squadron. We had a really talented ready room amongst the pilots. You know, out of 17 pilots in the squadron, five of us were prior Top Gun instructors, and that's just unheard of to have that much in one squadron. And so we had a few of our junior officers that came into the squadron, looked around the ready room and said, I'll never be this good. And so you have to sort of take that individual and build them up and build their confidence in themselves to actually go out there and get better and be able to fight the airplane.
James, any thoughts on that answer? Just, you know, from a Formula One perspective?
Well, I think in Chris's case, although everyone's got their own career to think about in on a squadron, I think it's much easier for a squadron to have a sense of sort of a fellow feeling with their fellow pilots and to have that camaraderie and teamship with their fellow pilots. I think it's much harder for teammates in a Formula One team because they're called teammates, but actually they are the two drivers for whom the entire world can make a direct comparison of their ability because they got the same kit. And that introduces a level of psychodrama that is quite intense because they get put on a stage every couple of weeks and incredibly visibly their performances relative to each other is set out for all to see. So how do we approach it? Well, I think we approach it, first of all, with a degree of sympathy to the loneliness of a Formula One driver. Because although all the rest of us in the team, we have this fantastic thing that provides us energy. And that is that we are really tight with one another. You know, everyone on the engineering side and the logistics side, we are real close group of colleagues, and we know that we derive our strength from how close we can be with each other. But the drivers are like gunslingers, and you know they are a different challenge for them. So we have to recognize their job is lonely. Although we want to be close to them from a technical point of view, we want to support them, they know that it's not a friendship like it can be with your teammates in the rest of the team. So we know that they have a sort of lonely job. We know that they are exposed in a way that none of the rest of us are. You know, they are out there with all their wares on show every weekend. So we try to be sympathetic to that by making sure that the team that we place immediately around them to support them will walk over broken glass to help them. There was absolutely nothing that the race engineers and the performance engineers and the support guys that we surround the driver with most immediately, nothing they won't do to make their driver's life easier. And that is a thing that I think the drivers recognize that we do. And then we try to make sure that we do that completely equally across the garage so that the driver can't look enviously across the garage and think, well, they've just got better people than me. We try to make sure we load both sides of the garage with people of the highest caliber and so that both feel well supported. And then despite the fact that these two groups, these individual groups are, you know, they are working for their guy, we also have to create an environment of absolute ruthless honesty of what each team is doing and let the other team have full visibility of that so that paranoia can't build up across the groups. And that takes a lot of effort to maintain that coordination just because a lot's happening in a short space of time and it takes a lot of energy to make sure that you're transferring all this information back and forth to keep each of them abreast of what the other is doing. But it's the least bad way of dealing with what is inherently a very unstable situation, which can run away from you very quickly quality if you're not being honest, giving people of good quality, and having this very transparent environment that's sympathetic to the inherent challenge that a Formula One driver faces.
You know, obviously not going to mention specific names or anything, but have you ever come across drivers, and I know you've worked with some of the best, that their personalities were more guarded about their skill level or talent? And did you have any, did you see any challenges with that?
You certainly can you can feel from time to time that a driver is in free practice not showing what he's got because they want to do it on Saturday when it counts in qualifying, and they don't necessarily want to reveal everything that they've got because there is this full transparency across the garage. Now, if we've got a suspicion that's happening, we'll try to reveal it in any case, just because full honesty is what we're about. But ultimately, if a driver is wily enough, then they can keep the last little bit hidden. But it's only hidden for that day on that event. You know, it will be there in the debrief, and it can be used the following year and the following race. So it's only a short term gain if that's what happens.
You know, a common question I get is how often do we kick somebody out of the course? And most people believe that we kick people out of the course, which doesn't happen very often, maybe a handful, maybe two a year on average. It often surprises people when I tell them that the reason we release them from the course and send them home is not talent. It's actually their personality. We talk about a lot at Top Gun about passion, personality, and talent. And I'm stealing that frame from my first Top Gun CEO, who was the one who coined it. But when we pick students to come through the course, or we pick pilots to be staff instructors on the Top Gun staff, what we're looking first and foremost for is passion, which I assume you don't necessarily have a problem with in Formula One. You know, to get to that level, there's got to be a high degree of passion. And probably more important than the passion, we're actually looking for the right personality. And it's a mix of sort of that blue collar mentality of I'm here to work, I'm here to go nose to the grindstone, and a strong sense of humility. There's got to be that humility. And if we have those two characteristics, we have the passion and the personality, we don't necessarily worry about their talent because they have the character there to build their talent and we can raise them to that next level. It's typically the folks that come in that are a little overconfident. They don't want to listen in the debrief. They think they're good enough that we work with and we give them opportunities. We counsel them, we mentor them. But at some point, you just got to go, look, I can't get you to the standard. I can't get you to the bar. So your time here is at an end, you know, that kind of mindset. So I was just curious if you see some of that with the drivers as well.
Well, I think we're lucky with our current pairing because, I mean, any F1 driver is, to be honest, they're all carnivores. They could not have got to an F1 seat without being extremely interested in what would, you know, what's good for them. And they will push for what's good for them very, very hard. You don't want a driver that's sort of got a bit of a sort of no after you type mentality. You want him pushing to the front with all he's got. Yeah. So we take for granted that we're going to have that type of personality to deal with. But what we're very lucky with our particular pairing of Valtteri and Lewis is that although they are both red-blooded carnivore types, they have a degree of respect which is unusually high for an F1 driver. And I've got plenty of examples of where both of them could have behaved badly, but have chosen to do the right thing because they see the longer term benefit to them of acting in the right way for the team. And I think they're both particularly mature in that way. And it's been hugely to our benefit as a constructor to have these two guys prepared to work with each other in a respectful way. And we don't take it for granted because if we did take it for granted, we would find that their willingness to do that would dry up fairly quickly. And we try to make it very clear when we've seen a behavior of that type, how much we appreciate it. And we try to show them that that is a really valuable and valued thing. And so, yes, it's been a really important thing for us. And we're just lucky. You know, I can think of several other driver pairings I've had where it hasn't been anything like as comfortable.
And how do you deal with that then?
very often it can just get to a point where it's not very recoverable, and you have to change the lineup because that particular pairing is just not a happy combination. And it can really suck the life out of the team. So much of the energy of the team is then devoted to managing the psychodrama between the two sides of the garage, and it becomes very draining.
I think largely, James, he would see a very similar environment just based on his comments from what he sees at Mercedes to what you would see at Top Gun. It's the same environment. I think another interesting element, too, that as I listen to James's comments that I would like to show him is the Top Gun stand board. The stand board is a meeting where we go in and we talk about ways that we could be doing tactics better, or we could use a combat system better. And I would equate that to initial car design and some of the compromises that you may make in the car design, and how do you make the car as best as you can for the season? And then going into each race, how do you make the car and set up the car as best you can for that track or that circuit? In the Top Gun stand board, as we go through those discussions and we'll have a SME that will throw out a recommendation, we will sit there and argue out that recommendation. You may agree with the recommendation, but you're still going to argue out and try to poke holes in that discussion and so forth. You may completely disagree with the recommendation and argue it out. And we've gone through arguments that have lasted 30 minutes, and we've gone through arguments that literally have lasted 5 days. And to kind of see that and how in-depth we're going through those discussions. And then most importantly, hands down, the most important part of the process is once we decide on a way forward, as soon as that door opens and everybody walks out, we are a unified front going forward. So I think in comparison to some of the compromises with the car engineering and the car setup, I think that would be an interesting thing for James to see.
It's interesting. The parallels are uncanny. We have a group called the Performance Group, which is a bunch of guys who work directly for me, who are our sort of most senior engineers on the performance side of the company rather than the logistics or the manufacturing or the operational side. And they meet once every couple of weeks, and they pick apart where our strengths and weaknesses are, where our opportunities might be to get better. And they argue, and sometimes they argue really passionately. Sometimes they'll get really cross with one another and not speak to one another for half a day or something, but they always kiss and make up. And the purpose of the argument is to agree with all the best information we can on what it is that makes our car go quick and what we need to do to make it go quicker. And when they close the door and they leave the argument behind them, that single purpose of what we're now going to do with the result of that argument then washes uniformly through the company, and they maintain that uniform front of this is what we're going to do. And it's been a very powerful force in our company. And the other thing that I was thinking, I was reminded of a time when I was in my teens on a Cold War airbase in RAF Germany, and they used to practice World War III all the time, and I used to train with the station rugby team during my school holidays. And I remember once being in a sort of big pile of guys all fighting over a ball that we were training with, and the hooter went to say, quick reaction alert, the scramble the jets, everyone get to work, there's a war on. And within seconds, I was the only person on this playing field. And all these guys had sprinted for their cars, and the tires were screeching, and they were gone. And that sort of, again, that common purpose is written right across the way the military goes about their business. And it's something that felt familiar and good to me when I was lucky enough to get involved in F1.
Chris, were you able to communicate all this, the passion and the cowboy time loving, to your good friend Tom Cruise when you were doing the Top Gun sequel, Maverick?
Yeah, we did talk about it a little bit. And obviously, he'd been in the building a couple times before we actually started the filming and so forth. And, when we sat down to talk about the movie and what the script was going to look like and so forth, there was a lot of passion on the film side and the film crew to try to replicate some of that as best as we possibly could. A lot of work went into the script to try to communicate that piece and try to get away a little bit from the sort of Hollywood perspective that fighter pilots are cocky and, we're all in it for ourselves and we can do whatever it is. World War III, it doesn't matter. Let's go do it. and more shows sort of, you know, the characters that we bring to work every day. You know, and this kind of goes back to a point that James made previously on a question. You know, there's a balance there. And this is kind of how I talk to it, what our culture looks like. You know, and we talk a lot about humility because we kind of need to emphasize the humility piece. But the reality is there's a balance there. When you walk up the ladder to get in the jet and you're strapping into the seat, you've got to know, just similar to a Formula One driver that's, you know, sitting on the grid waiting for the lights to go out, you've got to know that you can do this and that, you know, you can win. But the second you land and you strap, you know, de-strap from the seat and you're climbing down the ladder, that's where you got to go. All right, flight's done, event's done, the fight's done. Let's go back and talk about how we can do things better. And I think, you know, we tried to show some of that in the film. I would assume, you know, James probably sees that as well in the Mercedes team, to kind of go back to the driver dynamics there. We tried to replicate that as best we could in the film.
And you're going to go flying with Tom, I think, aren't you?
Hopefully we'll see. I didn't fly with him during the film because, you know, I wanted to get the junior officers flying and I wanted to highlight to the world just how talented our junior officers are. But hopefully at some point before film release, he'll come back and I'll take him flying. But he was fantastic through the whole thing. I will tell you that Tom is very, very passionate about what he does. He approaches sort of his leadership role, if you will, in the industry, very similar to how I approach leadership in the Navy. You know, it's not about him. It's not about him being a bigger superstar, whatever the case may be. I mean, I can't tell you how many times he said, you know, this is about the audience. We're trying to make the best film for the audience, which is exactly how I approach leadership. It's not about me as the leader. I'm not making decisions that benefit me in any way. It's all about the people I'm leading and trying to do the best thing that I can for them or pave the road out in front of them and keeping the focus on them to enable them to go after and execute whatever the goal is ultimately to win. And Tom really approached it the same way from a filming standpoint, which I thought was really impressive to see.
Well, James and Chris, I could continue talking to you and listening to the two of you for hours to come, but we have to call for a slight pause in proceedings as I welcome our third guest, Callum Douglas, to our discussion. Now, Callum is a motorsport engineer who's about to establish himself as the authority on fighter aircraft engines from the Second World War, specifically from the European theatre of war. The designs and the designers and intelligence used by the Allies and the Germans to discover each other's secrets. He's written a phenomenal book, The Secret Horsepower Race. And for those of us in Formula One, it makes for fascinating reading because it's all about piston engine development, how to get more horsepower, how to develop fuels and lubricants, how to do all of the things that today in 2020 are still absolutely central from an engineering point of view in the sport that we love. So, Callum, first of all, how are you?
I'm doing really well. This is such a strange experience. I started writing this in my bedroom 6 years ago, and to think I'd be sitting here with the technical director of Mercedes Formula One and a Top Gun instructor, I really don't think I would have believed you.
Yeah, well, you put a lot of work into this book. I have to say, when it landed on my hall floor, and actually nearly put a hole in the floor because it's a pretty weighty volume. And then, of course, to open the first couple of pages and discover that the foreword to your book is written by no less a man than James Allison himself. James, turning to you, just talk to us a little bit about your background with Callum, how Mercedes-Benz F1 and Callum and his book about this, the secret horsepower race during the Second World War amongst the fighter aircraft community. How did that come together for you?
We have a series of lunchtime lectures where people come to talk to us about interesting stuff. And I get along to some of them. But in Callum's particular case, I started to hear from various of my friends that we got this guy coming who was going to talk about piston engines from the Second World War, and it really was worth going along. And we had just had the best time listening to Callum talk to us about what he had researched and what he'd found in this fantastically important period for piston engine development. And there were so many similarities with our world in development of racing engines, and and the story was so sort of magnificent in its scope and its breadth. It captivated all of us. We talk about it quite a lot even now.
Now, Callum, some of our listeners will be astonished to hear James Allison, technical director of the 2020 7-times world championship winning Mercedes-Benz Formula One team, talk about the validity and the relevance of a book about aviation engines 80 years ago. Give our listeners some sense of what you uncovered during your research for this book about what was happening in Britain and Germany and the United States and Italy during that period, and how it is indeed relevant to what we are so fascinated about in Formula One today.
I found myself in a building on an airfield in Cambridge where all the technical documentation that was removed from Germany, borrowed, if you like, is still there. And doing some research for this book, I started opening up the technical reports, looking at this stuff, 80 years old, some of it even longer. I started reading it and I thought, I don't know how to do this. I'm supposed to be an engineer who's been through civilizational advance almost a century, and I don't understand what's being written. I don't mean the language being German. I mean the mathematics, the chemistry, the physics was so intensively studied. It's beyond my ability to interpret all of it. It was astonishing. It goes against everything I had thought was true for technological development, education, the passage of science and engineering, how we progress. And I started wondering, why don't I get this? How did they manage to do all this work? And that started a sort of giant investigation into how this had all happened, because I was so confused by how this advanced stuff had been sitting in a dusty building. And it was so advanced, I couldn't understand it. It's supposed to be my job to design engines. It's quite embarrassing when you read something a century old and you don't get it. That annoyed me so much, I thought, I'm going to have to find out what happened. And that's what led me down 6 years of finding it out.
So the interesting thing is that for a lot of listeners, some of the names that you have written so eloquently about and revealed so many details about are very familiar to us. Companies like Daimler and BMW and their development of aircraft engines from the 1920s and 30s through into the 1940s. And of course, how they reached the kind of the pinnacle of engine development in the Second World War, prior to the arrival of turbojets. And then in the UK, companies like Rolls-Royce and Ricardo, Harry Ricardo's company, still around today, still doing great work on engineering. And in Italy, Alfa Romeo and Fiat. So big names involved in a battle, literally a battle, but a battle also of engine development. And you have a really passionate belief in the fact that, you know, Formula One has a parallel to your lessons in this book, because essentially what we have is a peacetime engineering battle in Formula One. So talk to us about your findings in relation to the sense of urgency that warfare brings to something like engine development in the Second World War, and how perhaps we should be learning from that today in peacetime.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the book is so intertwined with Formula One in so many ways. The first time I realised that there was something special with it, I was working in the Mercedes-AMG engine plant in Northampton, and a couple of colleagues were just bored one lunchtime, and they said, we could go to the coffee shop, but why don't we just go to a meeting room? Can't you just knock some slides together of this stuff you've been digging up, and we'll just sit and watch that? And that was the first presentation I ever gave at Mercedes AMG Northampton. And that started this whole process. So everything has been really intrinsically intertwined with racing from the get-go. I've sent memos to guys I know at Ferrari, friends of mine, and they can't send memos back about what they do, but they can tell me what their impressions are. And I sent one of them a memo. This was from about 1941. It said, you've got 2 days to modify the boost controls, and if it reduces the engine life to less than 30 minutes, this is acceptable. I want all the work done by Friday. And someone at Ferrari, I know, read that, and he's got back to me and said, that could be in an email I got yesterday, except this time no one has to die, thankfully. And so just the huge urgency that this has to be done immediately at all costs, I think just seems to resonate with people who work in F1 because this is what they have to do.
I can tell you, Mark, some of the things that I took from the book that were just brilliant in their way, in their parallels with my world. The fact that when you're trying to do something technologically complex, which is not just about trying to imagine what the best engine could be, but also having to gear up for mass production, having to get it out to the front, having to be able to maintain and support it and get the whole supply chain lined up behind that task. Unless everything works, nothing works. And you can see in written across this story, you can see that some of the players had 90% of what they needed, but the missing 10% meant they might as well have not bothered. And, you know, that is a really, really strong parallel with our world. The fact that ultimately the way that you can prosper is the person who can learn the fastest will be the one ultimately that does the best in the end. So failure in itself is not a problem. It's how quickly can you learn from the failure, address the issue, and move forward as a result of it. That is at the absolute heart of the engine that drives Formula One development forwards.
Now, I can probably say this, James, but I found it quite amusing that the Italians were a little bit chaotic and that in the end they decided to license the Daimler engine. I don't know if that's something that could be done in 2020. There might be a few people in Maranello who might quite like to license the technology from Brixworth. Chris, can I turn to you? We have never discussed this. I mean, the history of aviation, naval aviation, the history of aircraft development, is that something that contemporary fighter pilots get any interest in? Is that something you get taught? Is it something that you're all inherently fascinated by with, or is it just ancient history?
Oh, no. I think in any business, you need to know the history of how that business developed and where you're at today and how you got there. I think most fighter pilots are intensely interested on going back to World War One, World War Two, and how they executed, how they fought, what they learned and so forth. So there's certainly a baseline interest in there. What I took from the book is just how similar it is to what we see today. I live in a world every single day I go to work where we are, from an engineering standpoint, innovating as best we can constantly. You know, you talked about some of the intelligence factors at the beginning of the book, and that still exists today, just like it existed back then. And so, you know, there's this similar to Formula One. There's this constant push to come up with the best, most exquisite systems that we can put out there and field into the fleet, into the military. And so we see this dynamic play out today. We just don't talk about it in mainstream constantly.
Ken, were you surprised that these engineers, designers, and so on from that period have not been given the credit they deserve? That it all got lost in the war and that was it, and well done, and on we go, life continues. But seemingly all of you are completely blown away with what they achieved, what they managed to do.
I think that it just comes down to a freak circumstance, really, due to the switch over to the turbojet, because you developed all this tech and then right when it's at its most interest, it vanishes because aviation went straight to the turbojet. So these incredible creations went from being the most intricate advanced machines on Earth to junk in a space of 6 months.
It's like a change in regulations.
from a military perspective. Exactly. And so all these papers were just sat because they were aviation papers. They weren't automotive. So you have to remember that the aviation world after that really had no interest in the piston engine stuff. So all these aviation guys said, okay, that's what we used to do. Gone. So it's been sat there doing nothing since then.
And Callum, just finally, your book published by Tempest Books. How do listeners go about purchasing a copy of your very fine book?
If you Google Morton's Books, Tempest is an imprint of them who deal with the aviation stuff. You can buy it direct from the publisher. It's also on Amazon, but Amazon tend to discount it. So it's cheaper for you. So if you're a bit hard up, I give you permission to use Amazon.
I love your honesty. So listen, everyone, buy it through Morton's Books is what Callum is saying. Isn't that right, Callum?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, that's terrific. Well, thank you very much indeed. Gentlemen, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
I think, Mark, if you wanted a book for lockdown, then The Secret Horsepower Race is one for you. It's a lot of pages. It's very heavy, but it's going to keep you going well into 2021. And it is a fascinating read. I mean, the amount of detail and the precision that Callum has gone to, and it'll involve and interest so many people, far more than I think people realize. It seems quite a dense and dry subject, but the more you probe it and the more you read, it is a great read, don't you think?
Well, if you're into engineering and technology, you'll be fascinated by it. If you're into the history of technology, you will be fascinated by it. Quite frankly, it is worth every penny of buying that book just to read James Allison's foreword, because he actually manages to condense his entire thought process about why the technological development during warfare is so paralleled in what we do in Formula One, this idea that Formula One is effectively a peacetime technological war. And it's great to read those words so that James managed, you know, put together for Callum's book, because it really excites you. And, you know, James Allison's own excitement for it comes across. So fantastic achievement by Callum. I cannot begin to imagine how he did that book over 6 years, vast amounts of work, quite frankly, groundbreaking historical research. And I think we'll get to hear about Callum for quite some time to come.
And he's got another book. I know he's going on the turbochargers. That's another project. Well, that's going to take 6 years. And you can understand exactly why, when you delve into the book, why it took him such a long time. And thanks to Callum, also to James and Chris for fascinating insights. And it'd be great to have them back again, maybe in 2021. Let's see where we go in terms of Formula One and what Chris's career is next, this next stage for him, as you might say. We talked about old school engineering and how that's still relevant today. What about old school tracks, Mark? Because we all got very excited, lots of drivers in particular, who've never raced at Imola, for example, or Mugello or Nürburgring, all those natural contours, the elevation changes, great locations. Formula One, for example, has just, in contrast, announced this new night race in Saudi Arabia. It's going to be in Jeddah before the race is meant to move to a new purpose-built venue in Qiddiya near Riyadh from 2023. Is this the right way forward, or do we need to listen to drivers and say, what a fantastic place. We need to keep the heritage. We need to keep that central to Formula One as much as reaching out to new global locations to increase the fan base and Formula One's appeal in an ever-changing media landscape?
It's been absolutely fantastic to tune in and watch Formula One around the Imola circuit again, and to see it arrive in Mugello in Tuscany, and the magnificent helicopter shots over the track there, and some great racing at those two venues as well. And then certainly in Portimão in Portugal, a track which I know well from my A1 Grand Prix days a decade ago. So it's been marvelous to see all of that. But I have to say, with my commercial hat on, I look at all of those and I don't see any money. And the problem is, money is vital to our industry, to the people employed in it. We've seen redundancies this year as a result of the global pandemic at McLaren Group. And a lot of the teams are still very clear about the fact that the impact of COVID-19 financially on Formula One is going to be quite substantial through next year. 2021's prize money will be based on the much reduced profits from 2020. So seeing a new track at Saudi, which undoubtedly is probably quite a wealthy race from Formula One's perspective, that's good news. That's Liberty and Formula One making sure that there's enough money coming in. They really need the sport to recover. There will be, of course, lots of discussions about human rights and political issues, and I've already seen some of that kind of feedback on my own Twitter feed. But the reality is, in the last 20 years, since Bernie Ecclestone expanded Formula One beyond its European heartlands to places like Malaysia and China and Bahrain and Singapore and Abu Dhabi, we've seen tens of millions of new fans exposed to our sport in countries and regions that it had never visited before. And that can only be a good thing, because we all want the diversity of our sport to increase. And so having diverse peoples and cultures introduced to Formula One can only be, I think, a positive thing as well. So it's going to be really exciting to see Formula One arrive in Saudi Arabia. Of course, the Saudi National Oil Company, Aramco, is a big sponsor of Formula One already. So we're seeing the Saudis doubling down in terms of their investment in Formula One. And while, as I say, it may be a political hot potato for some, I think just purely from a sporting perspective, this is certainly good for business. And let's hope it's going to be good for Formula One racing when we see that spectacular night race in Jeddah in a year's time.
This new track, by the way, is designed by Alexander Wurz. Qiddiya, he says, has all it takes to become the motorsport capital of the world. It's part stadium, part city section. And this is a key, I suppose, to all tracks, old school or new. You just want the racing to be good, close and competitive. We look forward to that happening from 2021 in Jeddah and then in Qiddiya from 2023. That's all we've got time for. We could go on and on. We've said this already with James Allison, Chris Papiano and Callum Douglas. Mark and I have had a fantastic time. I hope you've had enjoyed it as much as we have putting it together. Remember to rate and review, subscribe and spread the word, and we'll speak again on At the Controls in December.